severe impairment. More young people are experiencing not just symptoms of depression and not just feelings of anxiety, but clinically diagnosable major depression. With more than 1 in 9 teens and 1 in 11 young adults suffering from major depression, this is not a small issue. Even more than the data on rising loneliness and depressive symptoms, these gold standard data suggest that something is seriously wrong in the lives of American teens. Just as with depressive symptoms and loneliness, the increase in major depressive episodes is far steeper among girls, the gender more likely to overuse social media. By 2015, 1 in 5 teen girls had experienced a major depressive episode in the last year. Depressed teens are more likely to self-injure, such as through cutting. Fadi Haddad, a psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, told Time magazine, "Every single week we have a girl who comes to the ER after some social media rumor or incident has upset her. Those ER visits are almost always caused by girls cutting themselves." Between 2011 and 2016, 30% more college students said they intentionally injured themselves in the ACHA survey. Some teens discuss their cutting on social media. One study found that the hashtag self-harm zoomed from 1.7 million mentions on Instagram in 2014 to 2.4 million in 2015. The extra M's are apparently to express pleasure, a cruel irony born of the feelings of release some cutters say they experience. Many parents have no idea what their children are doing on social media, and many feel helpless, Haddad says. One mother found that her self-harming daughter had 17 Facebook accounts, which the mother promptly shut down. "But what good does that do?" asked Haddad. "There will be an 18th. Major depression, especially if it's severe, is also the primary risk factor for suicide. A high school classmate once confided to Utah State student Whitney Howard that she didn't understand how anyone could commit suicide. "How could things possibly be that bad? Little did she know that I was suicidal myself," Whitney says. "I tried overdosing on pain pills." Depression, she says, is an emptiness, an absence of feeling. It numbs you and strips you of happiness, hope, and enjoyment. Think of the Dementors from Harry Potter. Between 2009 and 2015, the number of high school girls who seriously considered suicide in the past year increased 34%, and the number who attempted suicide increased 43%. The number of college students who seriously considered suicide jumped 51% between 2011 and 2016. Suicide, a carefully tracked behavior unaffected by the possible irregularities of self-report surveys, is the most extreme and sadly objective outcome of depression. If suicide rates have risen, it would be strong evidence that depression has reached problematic levels. Unfortunately, it has. After declining during the 1990s and stabilizing in the 2000s, the suicide rate for teens has risen again. 46% more 15 to 19-year-olds committed suicide in 2015 than in 2007, and 2.5 times more 12 to 14-year-olds killed themselves. These are heartbreaking numbers. The rise in suicide is more pronounced for girls. Although the rate increased for both sexes, 3 times as many 12 to 14-year-old girls killed themselves in 2015 than in 2007, compared to twice as many boys. Although the suicide rate is still higher for boys, likely because they use more lethal methods, girls are beginning to catch up. For an outcome such as suicide, the end of a young and precious life, that is an extremely worrisome rise. It's also surprising, because more Americans now take antidepressants. 1 out of 10 in the last year, more than double the rate of the mid-1990s. Antidepressants are especially effective against severe depression, the type most strongly linked to suicide. Yet they haven't been enough to stem the growth of suicide among teens that started right around the same time smartphones became common. We can't say for sure that smartphones are to blame, but the timing is very suspicious. With twice as many young teens killing themselves, something clearly needs to be done. Why the rise in mental health issues? Although the rise in anxiety, depression, and suicide has occurred at the same time as the rise of smartphones, it makes sense to consider other causes as well. An article in The Atlantic blamed teen mental health issues almost exclusively on academic pressure. Students are challenged to take a demanding course of study to get a higher GPA. School is more challenging, said one high school counselor. But one good indicator of academic pressure is the amount of time students spend on homework. And as we saw in Chapter 1, time spent doing homework is less or about the same as in previous decades, with little change between 2012 and 2016, the years when depression skyrocketed. Plus, as we saw in Chapter 3, students who spend more time on homework are actually less likely to be depressed. Thus, it seems highly unlikely that too much time spent studying is the cause of the rise in anxiety and depression. Other causes also seem unlikely given the available evidence. We can apply a two-part test to possible causes. One, it must be correlated with mental health issues or unhappiness. See Chapter 3. And two, it must have changed at the same time and in the correct direction. Time spent doing homework fails both tests. It's not linked to depression, and it didn't change much over that time period. TV watching is linked to depression, but teens watch less TV now than they used to, so it fails test number two. Time spent on exercise and sports is linked to less depression, but it didn't change much since 2012, so they fail test number two, too. Only three activities definitively pass both tests. First, new media screen time, such as electronic devices and social media, is linked to mental health issues and/or unhappiness, and it rose at the same time. Second, and third, in-person social interaction and print media are linked to less unhappiness and less depression, and both have declined at the same time as mental health has deteriorated. A plausible theory includes three possible causes. One, more screen time has led directly to more unhappiness and depression. Two, more screen time has led to less in-person social interaction, which then led to unhappiness and depression. And three, more screen time has led to less print media use, leading to unhappiness and depression. In the end, all of the mechanisms come back to new media screen time in one way or another. By all accounts, it is the worm at the core of the apple. Of course, even with this evidence, these data can't definitively show that the shift toward screen time has caused more mental health issues. However, other studies can. Experiments that randomly assign people to experience more or less screen time and those that track behavior over time have both found that more screen time causes more anxiety, depression, loneliness, and less emotional connection. It seems clear that at least some of the sudden and large increase in depression has been caused by teens spending more time with screens. Another possibility is that iGeners are unprepared for adolescence and early adulthood due to their lack of independence. With iGeners less likely to work, manage their own money, and drive in high school, perhaps they are not developing the resilience that may come from doing things on your own. One study asked college students if their parents, supervised my every move, stepped in to solve life problems for me, and didn't let me figure things out independently. Students whose parents displayed those characteristics, often known as helicopter parents, had lower psychological well-being and were more likely to have been prescribed medication for anxiety and depression. Thus, reduced independence passes both tests. It is correlated with mental health issues, and it changed at the same time. The 2015 song Stressed Out by 21 Pilots captures this possible link between growing up slowly and mental health issues. In the music video, the band members ride oversized big wheels down a suburban Columbus, Ohio street and drink Capri Suns with straws. Lead singer Tyler Joseph says he wishes they could turn back time to the good old days when our mama sang us to sleep. Adulthood is also a sudden, unexpected reality. Their parents, they say, are laughing in our face, saying, "Wake up, you need to make money." He thought his fears would go away when he got older, he says, but now he's insecure and cares what other people think. The song was number two on the Billboard Top 100 for 2015, and the video has more than 800 million views on YouTube. As Asbury University student Alyssa Driscoll wrote, the song has exactly what we're thinking written in it. It really gets us. In the video, Tyler wears black makeup on his neck and hands, which he says is a metaphor for stress. It represents kind of a feeling of suffocation, he said in an interview. It makes sense. Trying to find your way as an adolescent can be difficult when your childhood was a protected cocoon and you were always told not to care what anyone else thinks. Suddenly, it matters what other people think. Suddenly, you have to be an adult, and that's stressful. Between student loans and treehouses, he sings, we'd all choose the treehouse. Stealing sleep. Just before you go to bed, you check on your teen. It looks as though her light is off, but you're not sure. Then you see it, the faint blue light of her phone as she looks at it in bed. Most iGeners are so addicted to social media that they find it difficult to put down their phones and go to sleep when they should. I stay up all night looking at my phone, admits a 13-year-old from New Jersey in American Girls. She regularly hides under her covers at night, texting so her mother doesn't know she's awake. She wakes up tired much of the time, but she says, I just drink a Red Bull. 13-year-old Athena told me the same thing. Some of my friends don't go to sleep until like 2 in the morning. I assume just for summer, I asked. No, school too, she said. And we have to get up at 6:45. Smartphone use may have decreased teens' sleep time. More teens now sleep less than 7 hours most nights. Sleep experts say that teens should get about 9 hours of sleep a night, so a teen who is getting less than 7 hours a night is significantly sleep-deprived. 57% more teens were sleep-deprived in 2015 than in 1991. In just the 3 years between 2012 and 2015, 22% more teens failed to get 7 hours of sleep. As always, it's difficult to say for sure what the cause is in a trend over time. Still, the timing of the increase is suspicious, once again occurring just as most teens began to have smartphones around 2011 or 2012. The increase is also larger for girls than for boys, and girls are more active on social media. If teens who spent more time online also slept less, that would be further evidence that new media and smartphones might be behind the lack of sleep. That is indeed the case. Teens who spent 3 or more hours a day on electronic devices were 28% more likely to get less than 7 hours of sleep, and teens who visited social media sites every day were 19% more likely not to get adequate sleep. The number of teens who don't sleep enough goes up after 2 or more hours a day of electronic device use, and skyrockets from there. An extensive meta-analysis of studies on electronic device use among children found similar results. Children who used a media device before bed were more likely to sleep less than they should, more likely to sleep poorly, and more than twice as likely to be sleepy during the day. Electronic devices and social media seem to be unique in their effect on sleep than are older forms of media. Teens who read books and magazines more often are actually less likely to be sleep-deprived. Either reading puts them to sleep, or they can put the book down at bedtime. TV time is barely related to sleep time. Apparently, teens who watch a lot of TV can turn it off and go to sleep, while those on their phones do not. The allure of the smartphone, its blue light glowing in the dark, is often too much to resist. Other activities that take up a lot of time, such as homework and working for pay, also increase the risk of missing out on sleep. But since teens spent about the same amount of time working and on homework in 2015 as they did in 2012, those activities are unlikely to be the cause of the increase in sleep deprivation since 2012. Other activities that take time, such as exercising and spending time with friends in person, actually correlate with getting more sleep. New media use is both the most strongly related to sleep deprivation and the only activity that increased significantly between 2012 and 2015. Thus, smartphones appear to be the primary cause of the recent increase in sleep deprivation, which means this new technology has adversely affected physical health as well as mental health. Lack of sleep can have serious consequences. Sleep deprivation is linked to myriad issues, including compromised thinking and reasoning, susceptibility to illness, increased weight gain, and high blood pressure. Sleep deprivation also has a significant effect on mood. People who don't sleep enough are prone to depression and anxiety. Sound familiar? Lack of sleep might be another reason why iGeners are more likely to be depressed. Teens who don't sleep enough are more than twice as likely to report higher levels of depressive symptoms, 31% do, versus only 12% for those who sleep more. Teens who sleep less than 7 hours a night are also 68% more likely to have at least one risk factor for suicide. Sleep deprivation is the ultimate buzzkill to mood, and over time, it can snowball into serious mental health issues. These risks look almost identical across gender, race, and socioeconomic status, so those factors are not the cause. Intriguing new research shows that the blue light emitted by electronic devices tells our brains it's still daytime, which makes the brain take longer to fall asleep. It probably doesn't help that social media exchanges, especially for teen girls, are filled with drama, not the best thing when you're trying to relax before bed. So, smartphones could be causing lack of sleep, which leads to depression, or the phones could be causing depression, which leads to lack of sleep. It's all rooted in the allure of the phone. When the phone calls its siren song, teens crash into the rocks instead of crashing into their beds. What can we do? According to his parents, Brian Goh, a junior at Caltech, wrote an email to a counselor at the university's counseling center asking for help. After a breakup with a girlfriend, he wasn't sure he had the will to go on, he wrote. The counselor told him she couldn't get him an appointment for several more days. Soon afterward, he killed himself. Caltech disputed that account, maintaining that Brian had denied that he continued to have suicidal feelings. Nevertheless, the case highlights a nationwide problem, the often inadequate resources for mental health assistance on college campuses. Waiting lists for appointments with therapists can be long, and budget cuts have meant fewer staff to minister to more students seeking help. Many campus counseling centers have limits on how many times students can see on-campus therapists. After Shefali Arora ran through the 12 sessions of on-campus therapy allowed for each student at Tulane University, the office handed her a list of off-campus therapists. "But I didn't have a car," she said. After taking a semester of medical leave, she attempted suicide, but thankfully did not succeed. High school students and their parents are already seeking help for psychological issues at an unprecedented rate. In 1983, only 4% of high school seniors, in the MTF survey, had seen a professional for psychological or emotional issues in the past 12 months. That figure doubled to 8% by 2000, and then rose to 11% in 2015. Thus, mental health providers are experiencing a larger caseload than in years past, a trend that is likely to continue. Practitioners need to prepare for an increasing wave of iGen clients. The bigger problems will occur if young people don't seek help. In college newspapers, iGeners themselves are sounding the alarm, calling for more recognition of mental illness and less stigma around it. "I worry about the lack of understanding that always seems to accompany any talk of one's emotional well-being," wrote Logan Jones in the Utah State Student newspaper. "Seeing a therapist is still taboo. Nobody likes the idea of putting a label on what can so easily be written off as some form of insecurity. Nobody wants to be diagnosed. More often than not, depression goes untreated. Even in our age of greater awareness of mental illness," Cooper Lund argues in the Daily Oklahoman, "depression is still stigmatized and undertreated. If I thought I might have cancer, I'd go running to the doctor. But when I thought I had depression, it took me 4 years to finally see a psychiatrist," he admitted. Help for mental health issues is essential, but of course it would be even better to stop depression and anxiety before they start. To do that, it would help to know what causes these mental health issues in the first place. Though some people have genetic predispositions to anxiety and depression, the abrupt rise in mental health issues strongly suggests that genetics is not the whole story. Recent research confirms this, finding that genetics and environment interact. Among those predisposed to depression, only those who experience certain environments will actually become depressed. For example, sleep deprivation is linked to depression. As we saw, teens are not getting enough sleep, and that's probably one reason why more are depressed. The decline of in-person social interaction and the rise of smartphones are likely another reason. In other words, there is a simple, free way to improve mental health. Put down the phone and do something else. Chapter 5. Irreligious, Losing My Religion, and Spirituality. Boys hurl themselves onto plywood ramps, their skateboards rattling under them as they leap. It's cold outside, and they're enjoying having a place to board inside. But it's not just any skate park. The boys fly through the air under dramatically arched ceilings, silently watched by a stone sculpture of St. Jones. Their skateboard park is the former Church of St. Joseph in Arnhem, the Netherlands. Like many other churches across Europe, the Church of St. Joseph closed as more Europeans disassociated from religion. Another Dutch church is now used as a school for acrobats, and a third is a high-end women's clothing store. Many others sit empty. The numbers are so huge that the whole society will be confronted with it, the Dutch religious heritage activist Lillian Groetsvegers told the Wall Street Journal. Everyone will be confronted with big empty buildings in their neighborhoods. For decades, the United States has been a much more religious country than most of Europe. Even as churches in Europe have emptied, Americans have remained very religious in comparison. For a long time, scholars of American religion maintained that religious practice and belief were relatively stable in the United States. The few changes that did appear, even among young people, were dismissed as weak and slight. Nobody was going to skateboard in American churches. Then came the millennials. As studies by the Pew Research Center showed in the mid-2010s, one in three millennials, then 20 to 34 years old, claimed no religious affiliation, much higher than the 1 in 10 Americans over age 70 who did not affiliate. However, younger people have always been less religious, and older people more so. Maybe millennials are less religious just because they are young. Since the Pew data go back only to 2007, that survey can't tell us whether millennials are less religious due to their age or to true generational and cultural change. To really tell how the American religious landscape is changing, it's better to draw from data that reach back across the decades, to compare young people now with young people of previous generations. With iGeners still emerging into adulthood, their religious orientation is a harbinger of what the United States will look like in the coming decades, whether that's shuttered churches or a new revival of American religion. Because most U.S. teens who identify with a religion are Christian, 68% of 10th graders in 2015, most of this discussion centers on Christianity and why teens are leaving it. Jewish, Buddhist, and Muslim teens remain small minorities in the United States at 1.6%, 1%, and 1.5% of 2015 10th graders, respectively. The coming years may see more discussion of these faiths and how they impact iGen. Part of the flock, public religious participation. Ben is a thoughtful 18-year-old from Illinois, one of the few iGeners I spoke with who loves paper books more than his phone. When I ask him whether he ever goes to church or religious services, he says, "Nope. Most of my friends don't either." I ask if he was raised that way or if he gave up on religion at some point. "My parents just never took us to church. They both grew up quasi-religious, but they never had us doing anything," he says. "I know one or two people whose parents still go to church and want them to, but they stopped." Affiliating with a religion was once a near universal experience for young people. In the early 1980s, more than 90% of high school seniors identified as part of one religious group or another, meaning that only 1 out of 10 chose none for his or her religious affiliation. As late as 2003, 87% of 10th graders affiliated with a religion. Then that changed. Beginning in the 1990s and accelerating in the 2000s, fewer and fewer young people affiliated with a religion. The shift was largest for young adults, with the religiously affiliated dipping to 66% by 2016. Thus, a full third of young adults do not affiliate with any organized religion. It's not just young people. iGeners are more likely than any generation before them to be raised by religiously unaffiliated parents. In the 2016 college student survey, 17% of students' parents did not belong to a religion, up from only 5% in the late 1970s. The drop in students' own affiliation is even steeper. By 2016, 31% did not affiliate with a religion. The gap between the religious affiliation of parents and their college student children has widened in recent years, though college students were always a little less likely to affiliate with a religion than their parents. The divide has now grown to a yawning gulf. This suggests that two forces are working simultaneously to pull iGeners away from religion. More iGeners are being raised in non-religious households, and more iGen teens have decided not to belong to a religion anymore. That seems to happen sometime between eighth grade and young adulthood, when adolescents begin to ask more questions and make decisions for themselves. iGeners came of age in an era when disavowing religious beliefs became strikingly more socially acceptable. In 2009, Barack Obama became the first U.S. president to include non-believers in an inaugural speech when listing religious groups. More and more Americans publicly challenge religion. In the 21st century, it has become clear that ancient religious texts are simply the creation of human beings. To believe otherwise is to define delusion, wrote Brian Scheller of Columbus, Ohio, on the New York Times website in 2015. Anything offered by religion can be found by another, less diluted manner of belief or behavior. Perhaps iGeners eschew affiliating with a religion but still go to religious services once in a while. In the past, many religious scholars argued that Americans were still as church-going as ever, or that any changes in attendance at religious services were small. But that's not true anymore. Attendance at services declined slowly until around 1997 and then began to plummet. In 2015, 22% of 12th graders said they never attended religious services. That is a very low bar. Going to a service even once a year would still count as going. The picture is the same for more frequent attendance. Only 28% of 12th graders in 2015 attended services once a week, down from 40% in 1976. In an interview on NPR, Father James Bretzky of Boston College acknowledged that only a small percentage of college students go to Mass, but noted that his church in suburban Bedford is filled with young families. They tend to come back to the church because they want their children to have some sort of religious education, he said. That suggests that iGeners and millennials are staying away from religious services because they are young, unsettled, childless, and far from situations such as death and sickness that religion comforts. Perhaps those generations will go back to religion later on when they have settled down. However, age can't be causing the difference in these data over time. iGeners and the millennials are less religious than boomers and Gen Xers were at the same age. The recent data on millennials, who are now in their family-building years, indicate that they are less likely to attend services than boomers and Gen Xers were at that age. In fact, the decline in attending religious services for this prime age group has been just as steep as that for young adults ages 18 to 24. Millennials have not been returning to religious institutions during their 20s and 30s, making it unlikely that iGeners will either. Faithful but different. Even though it's 10 p.m., 20-year-old James is wide awake and ready to talk. He's just gotten out of a business class at his university outside Atlanta, and when I call and ask, "Is this James?" he answers with a cheerful, "That's me." After we chat for a few minutes about his major, his parents, and where he's from, I ask if he went to church growing up. He tells me about the mostly white Baptist church he and his family attended in suburban Atlanta every Sunday at first, but then less and less often. "They were very conservative, very old-fashioned, which is fine. We're an old-fashioned family. We have old-fashioned ideals," he says. Despite this, there were issues from the beginning. "Our family had a hard time. My father is black, my mother is white, and both of us are biracial, me and my brother. We would walk into the church and get stares from everyone. Then, his brother came out as transgender at the age of 14, which was an immediate issue at church.
"Our church was not very LGBT-friendly at all," James says.
Once, he says, the pastor mocked another church that was more accepting of LGBT people, saying they might as well accept cheaters and murderers, too.
"Why would you celebrate sin?" the pastor asked. A few years later, James came out to his family as gay, after struggling with his feelings during middle school. He knew he was attracted to men, but he also knew that that wasn't accepted in his church.
"It was just basically fear. Like, you can't even think about that because you're going to go to hell," he said. "In the church, you had to put on major filters in order to be accepted. You couldn't be upfront with the things that you struggled with, or couldn't be upfront with things that you believed in, or they were going to get shot down."
Not surprisingly, James and his family stopped going to that church. Yet, he says,
"Right now, all four of us are still very much Christian. All four of us still have very strong beliefs."
His brother is very involved with his friends who are religious.
"I feel like he has gotten a lot more of that spiritual learning, spiritual feeling from sources outside of the church."
And even though James has moved away from church, he still longs for a religious connection.
"It's very important to me that my relationship with God and my relationship with religion is sound in my own mind, instead of trying to find fulfillment through the church," he says.
If James and his brother had been born 50 years ago, they might have stayed in the church and kept their identities hidden, at least for a time. But they are iGeners, and they are not going to hide who they are. Their challenge now is to find a church that supports both their identities and their deep Christian faith. That hasn't happened yet for James and his brother, but he's hoping it will once they are older.
"Being in college now, being busy, he's 18, I'm 20. Once I'm more secure and once my brother is more secure, finding a more permanent church would be a goal of ours," he says.
Losing my religion, private religious beliefs. When I ask 14-year-old Priya if she believes in God, she says, "I don't really know if there's like one person or a bunch of people or no one, so I'm keeping my views open. I'll figure it out." She only occasionally goes to religious services. "Sometimes my mom takes me along when she goes to the Hindu temple," she says, sounding uninterested. When I ask her if she ever prays, she says, "Not really. Sometimes I'm like, please, please give me a B or higher on this essay, so I guess I'm praying to the teacher? Or to some mysterious god of essays that does not exist, I'm pretty sure." For 20 years, headlines and academic articles declared that yes, fewer Americans affiliated with a religion, but just as many were praying, and just as many believed in God. Americans weren't less religious, they said, just less likely to practice religion publicly. That was true for several decades. The percentage of young adults who believed in God changed little between 1989 and 2000. Then, it fell off a cliff. By 2016, one out of three 18 to 24-year-olds said they did not believe in God. Prayer followed a similar steep downward trajectory. In 2004, 84% of young adults prayed at least sometimes, but by 2016, more than one out of four said they never prayed. Fewer young people believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God. By 2016, one out of four instead thought it was an ancient book of fables, legends, history, and moral precepts recorded by men. Thus, it is no longer true that Americans are just as religious privately. More and more Americans, especially millennials and iGeners, are less religious both publicly and privately. This is not due to shifts in ethnic or racial composition in the population. The trends are the same, and sometimes even stronger among white Americans only. By 2016, only 2 in 3 white young adults ever prayed, and only 60% believed in God. The waning of private religious beliefs means that younger generations' disassociation from religion is not just about their distrust in institutions, more are disconnecting from religion entirely, even at home and even in their hearts. I meet Max, 16, at his high school,
sitting just outside his classroom as the lunch period is about to begin. With his buzz-cut dark blonde hair and white and gray shirt, he would have blended in with teens in a 1950s school. His hobbies, though, are more modern. He spends all of his free time playing video games. When I ask Max if he goes to church, he says simply, no. He gives the same simple answer when I ask if he believes in God or prays. When I ask him what he thinks religion is for, he says it's great for supporting people, like if they're in a bad time. Like the saying, like if you're in the trench and you're being bombed, everyone's praying. He says that some of his friends' parents make them go to church, but his parents aren't religious. Some iGeners who do pray aren't exactly engaging in traditional religious supplication. I've stopped praying just to thank God. I only pray when I need something or when someone else needs something, wrote Tiara, 17. To be honest, I kind of just forget to pray until a bad situation arises and I want it to change. Others do follow a more religious approach, though, in their own way. The way I pray is simply talking to God, wrote Marley, 21. I don't get on my knees or act churchy about it. Prayer is personal. For several decades, belief in the afterlife was a notable exception to the trend away from private religious beliefs. More young adults in the mid-2000s believed in the afterlife than had in the 1970s. Perhaps some young adults wanted to believe in eternal life, even if they didn't want to go to religious services or believe in God. But even belief in an afterlife started to fade after 2006. Thus, late millennials and iGeners are markedly less religious than their close generational neighbors, the early millennials, and that's true across all four private religious beliefs: praying, believing in God, believing the Bible is the word of God, and believing in an afterlife. Another private feeling is the importance of religion in your life. And here as well, fewer teens are religious. By 2015, nearly one in four 10th and 12th graders said that religion was not important in their lives. The vast majority of teens said that religion was at least a little important to them until around 2000, when the number began to drop. Overall, iGen is, with near certainty, the least religious generation in U.S. history. Most iGeners do still participate in religion in some way. But there is now a relatively large segment of completely secular non-believers who don't participate in religion at all. They never attend religious services, don't pray, and don't believe in God. That growing segment is about 1 out of 6 eighth graders, 1 out of 5 tenth graders, 1 out of 4 twelfth graders, and 1 out of 3 college students and young adults. Having such a large number of young people completely disconnected from religion is unprecedented. It's also a likely portent of what is to come in American religion: fewer and fewer believers, and more churches closed down. We're not Europe yet, but that might be where we are headed. Religion versus the 21st century. It's a Monday around lunchtime when I reach Mark, 20, at his parents' home outside Fort Worth, Texas. Is this still a good time to talk? I ask. Yes, ma'am, he replies, his choice of words momentarily transporting me back to my own Texas upbringing. Mark has been raised in a devoutly Christian home. My parents are by-the-book Christians, by the Bible, all for the Bible, he says. He goes to church every Sunday, either to his parents' church or to a Dallas megachurch with his girlfriend. When I ask him if he prays, he says, I do pray, every day. I pray for blessings over everyone that I know, hand of protection. I pray God will give me wisdom in life, and that he'll make me the person he wants me to be. He says his life's goal is this: I want to be able to get out of bed, and when my feet hit the floor, the devil goes, oh crap, he's up. That, I thought as I laughed out loud, is real faith. At the same time, Mark is iGen, and during the hour we talked, I could almost visibly see the push and pull of his evangelical Christian faith wrestling with the 21st century iGen world he inhabits. When we talk politics, same-sex marriage never comes up in his list of important issues. When I finally ask about it specifically, he says, yes, I know same-sex marriage is wrong because it can never physically work out for the reproduction of life.
But everybody has their own viewpoint, and if they want to go out and have a same-sex lover, then there's really nothing you can do. It's not like you can force them to like the opposite sex.
Trying to decide whether to have sex before marriage also left him pulled in two different directions. He didn't get involved with the hookup scene at his public high school, but 2 years later he met his girlfriend, whom he describes as the right person, and they eventually decided to have sex. They plan to get married after college, he tells me.
It's tough, though, because who knows how long you're going to be in college, right? I ask.
Exactly.
Whether it's 2 years out of junior college, 4 years, 6 years, 8, 10 years, I know people who have been in college for 12 years, he says.
Still, he describes not waiting until marriage to have sex as a failure.
90% of people fail, and I was one of those who failed, he says.
You waited longer than most people, so I wouldn't call that a failure, I say.
Well, true, but I wouldn't mark it up as a victory either. My girlfriend said it was the right thing to do, and it would have been nice to wait, but she said I'm glad we did what we did.
It turns out that he's in the majority. A recent study found that 80% of unmarried young adult evangelical Christians have had sex. But Mark is still not sure.
If I could tell, like, a younger brother who was in my position, I'd say wait until marriage, he says.
Mark was both keeping his faith, but also acknowledging the reality of his iGen world. His views may represent the future of Christianity. Assuming that he and other iGeners like him keep their faith, they will usher in a new, more tolerant era of Christian belief that steps away from what people should not do to focus on what they should do. Spiritual, but not religious, has become not spiritual and not religious. Another common narrative about trends in American religious belief says that spirituality has replaced religion. In 2001, the religious scholar Robert Fuller penned a book called Spiritual But Not Religious, arguing that most Americans who eschew organized religion still have deep and dynamic spiritual lives. That theory is often mentioned in relation to young people. The assumption is that young people who are distrustful of traditional religion are still willing to explore spiritual questions. That might have been true at one time, but no longer. iGeners are actually less spiritual, as well as being less religious. iGeners and late millennials, ages 18 to 24, are the least likely of all age/generation groups to say they are a spiritual person, showing a pronounced break even with older millennials in their late 20s and early 30s. The age-generation differences look very similar to those in identifying as a religious person. Older generations are the most likely to identify as both religious and spiritual, and younger generations the least likely. Of course, these differences could be due to age instead of generation. Perhaps younger people have always been less spiritual. However, slightly fewer 18 to 24-year-olds in 2014 to 2016, 48%, described themselves as a moderately or very spiritual person than in 2006 to 2008. 56%. Other data bear this out. In the American Freshman Survey, the percentage of college students who described themselves as above average in spirituality fell from 45% in 2000 to 36% in 2016. When sociologist Christian Smith interviewed young people about their religious beliefs in the late 2000s, most did not even know what he meant when he asked them if they were spiritual.
What do you mean, spiritual seeking? Many asked.
So the idea that young Americans in recent years are less religious but more spiritual doesn't hold up. They are less spiritual than their elders. Spirituality has not replaced religion among the young. For years, religious scholars and observers have argued that the decline in American religious life is explained by other factors, or isn't important. It's because this generation is still young. This generation just doesn't like institutions. Americans are just as likely to believe in God and pray. More Americans are now spiritual instead. The changes are small. The most recent survey data, which you've seen here, knocked down every one of those explanations. It's not age, because boomers and Gen Xers were perfectly happy to be religious when they were young.
Ai-jen is less religious even in beliefs that don't require religious institutions. Fewer Americans now believe in God or pray. Fewer, not more, young adults are spiritual. The number who do not participate in religion has doubled. Ai-jenners are less religious and less spiritual, publicly and privately, and strikingly different from previous generations when they were young. The move away from religion is no longer piecemeal, small, or uncertain. It is large and definitive. More young Americans are thoroughly secular, disconnecting completely from religion, spirituality, and the larger questions of life. These complete non-believers are still a minority, but their numbers have swelled significantly in a very short period of time. More Ai-jenners than any other living generation are unconnected to religion. Here's the question, which ones? The chasm, religious polarization by race, socioeconomic status, and region. Not that long ago, religion was a nearly universal American experience. White or black, rich, middle class, or poor, in Boston or Atlanta, Americans went to religious services and identified with a religious tradition. The specific religion or denomination may have differed: more Baptists in the South, more Catholics and Jews in the Northeast, more Lutherans in the Midwest, more well-off Episcopalians, Christian churches segregated by race, but all demographic groups went to religious services at about the same rates. Ai-jenners have changed that, continuing trends begun by millennials. Races, socioeconomic groups, and regions differ in their religious service attendance much more than they did a few decades ago. The religious landscape is now more polarized based on identity. Most generational trends are remarkably similar across demographic groups. The correlation between race and religious participation is the largest exception to that rule, with strikingly different trends over time for white and black teens. In the early 1980s, black high school seniors were only slightly more likely than white ones to ever attend religious services. But by 2015, the gap was much larger. Until very recently, black teens' religious service attendance barely budged, while white teens' attendance plummeted. Black Ai-jen teens might be following the lead of white teens. The declines in religious service attendance since 2009 among black teens are the most consistent in decades. Black Ai-jen teens might be the harbinger of a move away from religion in the black community that may take hold in the years to come. Still, the gap between white and black teens in religious service attendance, once small, is now a wide gulf. Beliefs have also diverged. In the late 1980s, black and white American adults were nearly identical in their belief in God. But by 2016, blacks were much more likely to be believers than whites. This is for adults of all ages to ensure that there are enough people in each group. So although black and white Americans could once assume they had belief in God in common, now the races are much further apart in this fundamental religious belief. The 2016 election exposed the divide between working class and college-educated Americans. Yet, there is one class difference that is rarely discussed, perhaps because it is misunderstood. Contrary to popular belief, teens from families with a college-educated father are actually more likely to attend religious services than those whose fathers did not attend college. That was not always true. In the 1970s and 1980s, teens from both types of families went to religious services at about the same very high rate. That began to change during the 1990s, and in recent years, teens from higher SES families were more likely to go to religious services. The recent gap isn't as large as that for race, but it follows the pattern of increasing polarization over time, with teens from different backgrounds having different religious experiences, whereas they once had near universal exposure to religious services. However, the same was not true for beliefs. The decline in belief in God was similar among all adults regardless of their education level. Regions of the United States have also become more polarized. The South is often known as the Bible Belt, which I experienced firsthand growing up in Irving, Texas, which at one time claimed to have more churches per capita than any other city in the country. Religious service attendance didn't differ much by region in the 1970s and early 1980s. But by 2015, there was a larger gap in religious service attendance, with more southern teens attending services at least occasionally, The MTF survey stopped asking this question in California in 1997, so we can't compare residents of the West. Belief in God has also diverged across regions. In the 1990s, the percentage who believed in God was once about the same in the South and the rest of the country, with Southerners just a little more likely to believe. But views have sharply diverged since then, with a belief in one higher power barely budging in the South, while it declined in the Northeast, Midwest, and West. By 2016, only 1 out of 5 white Southerners did not believe in God, compared to nearly 1 in 3 white non-Southern residents. The image of the godless North may be long-standing, but it became partially accurate only in the 21st century. This religious division by region may be the product of the new choices Americans have enjoyed over the last few decades to move wherever they like. People cluster into neighborhoods of people like themselves, growing ever more isolated from those with different views. As recently as the 1990s, religion was a near universal in America, whether black or white, northern or southern, rich or poor. A high school student could look around her classroom and expect that those sitting around her were religious. Now, about 1 out of 4 are non-believers, but many more if you're in a classroom of mostly white students in the Northeast, and many fewer if your classroom is mostly black students in the South. Over time, this polarization may lessen if black Americans and Southern residents become less religious. For now, the chasm remains. Too many rules. Why religion has declined. I don't pray, nor do I believe in an omniscient God, wrote Brittany, 19. I like to think that your whole life isn't planned out already for you, and that your choices determine who you become. Why has Brittany's view become more common? Why are young Americans now less religious? As with the other trends, we can identify things that changed at the same time that are also linked to lower levels of religious commitment. Brittany's reasoning hints at one possible cause, American culture's increasing focus on individualism. As she put it, your choices. To more precisely analyze the link between religion and individualism over time, I matched those indicators of individualism with teens' religious service attendance by year, so that each year was associated with an average level of, say, individualistic language in books, and an average level of religious service attendance. The rise in these individualistic factors moved in lockstep with the decline in religion. More individualistic times were less religious times. That makes sense, given that religion by definition involves believing in something bigger than yourself. It also often involves following certain rules and joining groups, two other factors that don't fit particularly well with an individualistic mindset. In a society where young people hear, if it feels good, do it, and believe in yourself, religion seems almost countercultural. As we saw in the stories of James and Mark, iGen faith often involves a careful balance of individualistic modern realities with traditional religious doctrines, particularly around issues of sexuality, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Even religious teens often adhere to a more individualistic version of faith. When Christian Smith interviewed young people for his book, Soul Searching, he found that many adhered to a belief system he labeled moralistic therapeutic deism, which embraces a belief in God, but also includes more uniquely modern ideas, such as the importance of happiness, feeling good about yourself, and the idea that God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life, except when God is needed to resolve a problem. Smith also found that most teens embraced moral individualism, his label for teens' idea that we are all different and that's good. 12-year-old Harper, whom we met in Chapter 2, sees an individualistic purpose for church. Church is for people to express their beliefs. There's certain churches for certain people, like what they believe in. It's a place that you can meet people who believe in the same thing as you. In You Lost Me, Why Young Christians Are Leaving Church and Rethinking Faith, his book about young former Christians, David Kinnaman reports that many young people feel a disconnect between their church and what they experience outside of it, including science, pop culture, and sexuality. For example, half of 13 to 17-year-olds
want to pursue a science-related career. Yet only 1% of youth pastors say they have addressed any subject related to science in the last year. Kinnaman told the story of Mike, 20, who was invited to tell a room full of pastors why he no longer affiliates with Christianity.
"I'm as nervous as an atheist at a pastor's conference," he began. But then he said, "It was 10th grade. I started learning about evolution. I knew from church that I couldn't believe in both science and God, so that was it. I didn't believe in God anymore."
If his church had not presented things as so black and white, he said, he might have stayed.
Other iGeners echo that idea. "My father is an atheist and my mother is agnostic. We're science people," wrote Timothy, 23. "Religion, at least to people my age, seems like it's something of the past," says Matthew, whom we met in chapter 1. "It seems like something that isn't modern."
Then there's the elephant in the room. Many millennials and iGeners distrust religion because they believe it promotes anti-gay attitudes. More young people now associate religion with rigidity and intolerance, an automatic anathema to a highly individualistic and accepting generation. "I feel like some of the worst people who are the most bigoted and closed-minded are religious," wrote Sarah, 22. "My stepsister is constantly posting things on Facebook about how good she and her religion are, while posting hateful things about gays, people who eat pork, and anything else she doesn't agree with." That has hit some iGeners personally. "No, I do not pray," wrote Ernest, 21. "I'm questioning the existence of God. I stopped going to church because I am gay and was part of a gay-bashing religion." A 2012 survey of 18 to 24-year-olds found that most believed that Christianity was anti-gay, 64%, judgmental, 62%, and hypocritical, 58%. 79% of the non-religious believed that Christianity was anti-gay. "I'm religious and I love God," wrote Michelle, 22. "But the rules are too strict, and some of them are prejudicial, like not liking homosexuality. How can you love everyone except gays, transgenders, and people who don't believe in our God? I think people don't want to live with that kind of thinking anymore. It's a disgusting way to treat other people." These views came up over and over again when I asked iGeners about religion. Kelsey, 23, told the story of a gay friend of hers who was kicked out of Bible school in middle school because he was gay. He then hid being gay for years and felt horrible about it. She concluded, "That is why people do not want to associate with religion. Nobody wants to associate with something that tells people their sexual preference is a sin. God loves all. God just wants you to be nice." David Kinnaman's book, Unchristian, reported that 4 out of 10 young people outside Christianity have a bad impression of the religion. Why? As Kinnaman put it, we have become famous for what we oppose, rather than who we are for. Community college student Haley, 18, is not religious herself, but works at a part-time job with many people who are. When we meet for lunch one day in San Diego, she tells me that many of her coworkers are intolerant toward gays, lesbians, and transgender individuals. She has no issue with their religious beliefs, but does with their intolerance. "If you are religious, if that helps you become a better person, good. That's what religion should do. Help you become a better person and treat others better," she says. "If that's not what it's doing, you're using it for hate, you're using it for your soul, social, and moral code, then you're going to be a messed up person." So what do iGeners want from religion? Many echo Kinnaman's assessment, saying they want religion to be more positive and less negative, to focus on what to do rather than what not to do, and to accept everyone. Tess, 21, grew up Catholic. When my cousin was 21, she learned she was pregnant and went to confession for guidance. Instead of the priest telling her of God's forgiveness and giving her hope for herself and her future child, he shamed her until she cried all the way home, she wrote. How does something like that appeal to people? Even if it wasn't God directly shaming her, the leaders of the church are still the medium in which the message of the Lord comes through. God's word should foster happiness and faith, not self-loathing and hopelessness. iGeners don't see the need for enforcing rules around sexuality
since most of them see these prescriptions as hopelessly outdated. Millie, 19, noted that the ideals of religions conflict with what people believe to be normal in modern society. For example, the Bible says no sex before marriage, but in today's society, sex is considered a normal, healthy part of non-marital relationships. People may even find it strange nowadays if you haven't had sex before marriage. Getting married just isn't considered a necessity to us, but rather a choice in a variety of options. iGeners want to interact with religion and not just be told what to do. Trevor, 20, wrote, "Young adults want answers about life and about who we are, why this even matters, what we can do. Instead, we get told just to pray or a handout worksheet about Bible verses." Vanessa, 21, echoes this thought. "The church should make things more interactive to keep people actively thinking instead of just listening to someone speaking at them." This suggests that religious organizations should focus on active discussions with iGeners that address the big questions they have about life, love, God, and meaning. Kinnaman found that 36% of young adults with a Christian background said that they didn't feel they could ask my most pressing life questions in church. Just as education is moving away from the straight lecture format toward more interactive group discussions, religious organizations could consider gatherings that encourage parishioners to participate and to question. Mark, whom I met earlier, says he likes the megachurch he attends because you're at church to learn more about God and know that you're not alone throughout whatever experience you're having. People give testimonies all the time, and it's nice to know someone else went through the same thing you did and they turned out fine, so you're going to be fine. There's progress on some counts, however. One church in Oregon invites parishioners to ask any question about faith, and questions can be asked via text and Twitter. iGeners don't want to be told exactly how to live their lives and what to believe, but that can be a strength, because if they come to beliefs themselves, they might be more likely to keep them. Europe with bigger cars, the future religious landscape. Many Americans see the trend away from organized religion as profoundly negative. "This is family," said Lorraine Castagnoli, who attended one of the 8 Catholic churches shuttered in Westchester and Rockland, New York in 2015. "With this church closing, a part of my soul and my heart is dying. We come together all the time, and it's just sad." Religious leaders lament the loss of communities and note that religious people tend to be healthier and happier. "At the end of the day, most of us will figure out that we have a dimension that takes us beyond ourselves," said Father James Bretzky of Boston College. "There's a transcendental pull in our lives, and religion offers deeper meaning and some deeper answers." According to a 2012 Pew Research Center poll, most Americans, 56%, believe that the decline in religion is a bad thing, while only 12% believe it's a good thing. Others see positives in religion's decline, such as Ronald Lindsay of the Center for Inquiry, which works to reduce the influence of religion on public policy. Americans, he theorized, are no longer looking to the church as an authority on issues. These are issues they feel comfortable in deciding themselves. People are still seeking community, but they're no longer seeking it in the context of organized religion. When the decline of religion is discussed online, many mention the negative history of religion in persecution and hatred, often specifically bringing up LGBT issues. In Europe, half of the population disavows religion, and many churches sit empty. And as more U.S. churches close, charities run by religious organizations will begin to crumble. By the time iGeners have children of their own, the way the nation interacts with religion will look quite different. Will any religion survive? Evangelical churches have not lost as many members over the last few decades as other Christian denominations have. That might be because they've recognized that iGeners and millennials want religion to complete them, to strengthen their relationships and give them a sense of purpose. Some of those churches will begin to loosen their views on premarital sex, same-sex marriage, and transgender individuals as their acceptance becomes more mainstream, even among religious people. Religion will survive, but it will be a flexible, open, equal religion that gives people a sense of belonging and meaning, and that reaches less than half of Americans.
It is unclear where iGeners will find community interaction to replace religion. Perhaps they won't find it at all, content to rely on their social media network with deleterious impacts on their mental health. Or perhaps iGeners will affiliate with others who share their interests, rather than building community through religion. Either way, the structure of American community will fundamentally change. Chapter 6. Insulated, but not intrinsic. More safety and less community. The sun has just begun to burn off the morning's gray clouds when I arrive at my favorite San Diego sushi restaurant on a June day just before noon. Haley, 18, is already there, rising to meet me as I walk in. She's part white and part Asian, with a warm smile that lights up her eyes behind her glasses. Over shrimp tempura and a dragon roll, we talk about everything from jobs